So now, starting from this Poisson bracket, I first want to show you how the representations of G come from. And for that, it is convenient I will sketch a couple of concepts of Hamiltonian field. A momentum map. Why they are useful. And so the idea is that given any function on a given Poisson manifold, which I can think of it as being the Hamiltonian, I can associate to it a vector field. And the idea is that this vector field, I want that the action of this vector field, so the integral curves of this vector field, are just given by the action, by the usual Poisson bracket. And you see why it's called Hamiltonian field, because in a given coordinate system, what this object is doing is just providing me some equations of motion that are of the form xt. So it's just usual Hamiltonian mechanics. And I can define this kind of vector fields in a very convenient way in case I have a symplectic structure, because locally I can just define them like these, which is somehow equivalent to say that so given an Hamiltonian, I can associate a vector field, and given some vector fields, I can just associate an Hamiltonian. And what is important here is that if I look at the Lie bracket of these vector fields, I obtain the vector field that is obtained, evaluated into the into the point that is obtained by taking the Poisson bracket of these two objects. So this is why I'm introducing this concept, because I want to arrive up to representations of the algebra through the use of these vector fields. And well, you can rewrite things abstractly, but it's not so crucial. And now I want to identify the vector fields that correspond to very special displacement on the manifold, that are the displacement that are generated by the G action. And if you wish, I want to have a sort of canonical representation of displacement that are induced by the G action, or if you wish, I want to represent symmetries canonically. So it's something that you have seen in Adrian's talk. Here I want to do it really bottom up from the very basics. And to this end, what is convenient is to introduce essentially a generator of this object, which is called a momentum map. And so the idea is that I have a vector field which generates an infinitesimal, which is a generator of an infinitesimal group action. So this means that this object, given a Lie algebra element, I can look through the exponential map at the group action on a given point of a manifold at t equal to zero. So Q is just the point of a manifold in this case. And I'm doing this because this is just a kind of very general definition. And then we will specify it to the case of quadratic orbits. Okay. And essentially, now my goal is to find a J of X such that Xi of X is equal to the Hamiltonian vector field associated to this function there. And these J of X are what are called momentum maps. And why is this important? Because if I manage to achieve this goal, I can indeed show and that is the that I can the infinitesimal action well, if I manage to get this goal, what I can find is just that the Poisson bracket of momentum maps acting on an arbitrary function will be equal just to the momentum map associated to the commutator. So, which means that if I manage to achieve this, I'm going to discover that again, I can strip the function f. I'm getting a representation of my algebra up possibly to a central extension. Okay, so this is why it's interesting to introduce these tools. In the case of coadjoint orbits, there will be a canonical way to introduce these momentum maps. And the end result is that this won't be there for coadjoint orbits. Which are very specific symplectic manifolds. But this kind of introducing Hamiltonian fields is kind of very generic feature of the symplectic geometry. And associating to them a momentum map is something which is also pretty standard. The fact is that in general, not all group actions on a given manifold may have an associated momentum map. But in the case of coadjoint orbits, the advantage is that I can always find a momentum map. So maybe just short, even if I don't have much time. So since this is an important result, because essentially is what is telling me that indeed I can relate this symplectic geometry to representation of groups. So let me sketch how you can prove it. And the idea is that I am assuming that it exists a way to represent, well, by definition, the infinitesimal variation of a function along the direction specified by x is given in this way. So it's generated by a momentum map. This is the non-obvious part of the story. And another thing that I can use is the fact that also this I don't have time to show you, but is that if I have some vectors that generates infinitesimal displacements, infinitesimal group actions, then they satisfy the following algebra. Yeah, now we can just put together these two statements. So this is, not, again, non-obvious, but is a kind of theorem that I'm going to use. And putting them together, I can just rewrite my Hamiltonian, sorry, the momentum maps. This is using Jacobi. I can write it as being Jx, Jyf. And now I'm using this non-obvious fact that I can relate my momentum maps to infinitesimal actions. Okay, and this essentially by using this relation here is telling me that here I have nothing but the Lie commutator of these two objects acting on the function f. And now using the little theorem there, I can conclude that this is just given by the action of this vector acting on the function phi, on the function f. And then just by translating back, I obtain what I wanted to prove. Okay, so then it's a solid result that if I found the momentum map, then I can obtain a representation of a group action. And just a quick note about what are the momentum maps, because again, here it looks like a very formal definition, but actually important property of a momentum map that if you are interested, we can discuss later, but I don't have time to show you in detail, is that JX, this object there, is constant along the integral. So if I have a function h, which is group invariant, so that h of g of p, then jx is constant along the integral curves of the integral curves of H, or if you wish, this is the same as saying that we can prove that the Poisson bracket of a momentum maps with this Hamiltonian is always equal to zero. So if you wish, momentum maps are associated to conserved quantities in the spacetime. So, or are the charges that we have seen in a kind of asymptotic context. Okay. Okay, perfect. And now the kind of next statement that I need, and again, if you wish to see the details, we can discuss them later. But the point is that for coadjoint orbits, there is always a momentum map. And by the way, it's also taking a form, which is pretty simple. And it is just the fact that just given by the pairing. So this means that for coadjoint orbits, I can always arrive up to this stage. So I can always build quantities that gives for me a representation of my group. And that is a completely general statement. And this is a, well, kind of little computations that you can do using the same techniques, having the adjoint representation that jumps from one side to the other that I discussed before. And the summary is that given whatever group I can, and whatever point belonging to the dual of its Lie algebra, I can define this object, the coadjoint orbit. And the coadjoint orbit is a symplectic manifold. And by the way, I haven't stressed it yet. This means that in the finite dimensional case, it must have dimension even, necessarily, because it is of a symplectic manifold. And the action of G on these coadjoint orbits is what is called a symplectomorphism, and it is Hamiltonian. What does it mean that it is Hamiltonian? It means that I can always realize the group action by means of a canonical action of these momentum maps, by means of a Poisson bracket that I can associate to this symplectic, to this symplectic form. And yes, and the form of the momentum maps of the generator of the objects that, that generates this displacement, that this is another thing that is kind of useful. So this is the generator that, in the case of the coadjoint orbits, we have proven that the action, the group action acts via the coadjoint representation on the tangent. So the vector that generates the group action is just a coadjoint, is given by the coadjoint action of the algebra. And this object, I can also I can always realize it in this way, where the Poisson bracket is again, it's just the Poisson bracket that is associated to my locally, which is associated to my invariant symplectic form. Okay. Now, all of this is nice, is good, but as I said, it's a bit of kind of overshooting in some cases. So I wish to represent, to show you a kind of different way of getting the same result that is more useful, somehow probably for finite dimensional groups, but I think is worth mentioning. While what I, the kind of approach that I presented you is more useful for infinite dimensional ones, I would say. But I will mainly maybe sketch at the very end by skipping the intermediate details. So, okay. So the other approach is that I can define actually a Poisson bracket on the full phase space, on the full G star, in the following way. Where I denote in this way just the tangent vector, so the differential of F. And to any function F, I can associate always its Hamiltonian field such that, so somehow it seems N the Lie bracket of Hamiltonian fields is Hamiltonian. As we already have seen. But it's something that I have rewritten it because it will be important shortly. And so what's the difference with respect to what we have done before is that now I define this object directly on G star. So not on the co-adjoint orbits. I define it on the wall dual. And now I have to understand how I, if I can use this object in order to define, to recover the symplectic structure that anyway I already introduced to you. So in this sense, this kind of deviation wouldn't be necessary, but it's kind of useful to understand a bit better what is going on. And the key here is the fact that the Lie brackets of two Hamiltonian fields is Hamiltonian again, because then I can use Frobenius theorem and saying that this G star is foliated in symplectic leaves. And a symplectic leaf simply is a submanifold on which I have a symplectic form, so a non-degenerate, anti-symmetric, enclosed form. And 2 points on a given symplectic leaf are just related by the Hamiltonian, by the integral curve of an Hamiltonian field. So I can classify all the Hamiltonian fields, I follow them along the curves, and this is foliating my space G star. So we have two foliations. The foliation that is given by the Hamiltonian fields defined here, and the foliation given by coadjoint orbits, and one can prove that they are actually the same. So I have also another possibility, so I start from this, and then I look at the symplectic leaves generated by Hamiltonian fields. And again, so once I have a non-degenerate linear form and so on and so forth, I can repeat all the story. And well, the idea is that in order to show that the symplectic leaves are just coadjoint orbits, I can just consider again, once again, an integral curve for an Hamiltonian field, for a given Hamiltonian field. And these objects, once again, we have seen this kind of identification several times. Belongs to the tangent space of G star, but the tangent space of G star is G star itself. And now we can prove that gamma point of T, which is the object that I define here, can also be rewritten So this is the differential along the curve t of the function, which is h of gamma t. But again, if I manage to prove this identity, I showed you that essentially the, this kind of integral curves that defines for me what the symplectic leaves are realized in terms of coadjoint orbits. This means that the two foliations are actually the same. And then this is another way of putting a coadjoint orbits on these. And since it's important kind of statement, let me kind of prove it very quickly. So I want to look at one side of this identity. And this is something that by definition is just, I want to act with my Hamiltonian field. And since the Hamiltonian field, since the field is Hamiltonian, this is just given by the Poisson bracket. But then I just take my definition of Poisson bracket that you hopefully still see, can see above. And this is given just by the commutator of the two differentials of the two functions that I have here. But this object here is just, again, by definition, it's always a game of recalling all the definitions that are around of TP, of the differential of H acting on the differential of F. But then I have a pairing. I can use the pairing to let the adjoint representation jump on the other side and become the coadjoint one. And this means that I obtained somehow the coadjoint representation. And well, that should be enough to conclude in the sense that this is natural. Since I have this identification between the tangent space of G star and G star itself, I can also try to rewrite this object as being CH of P, TP of F, and then the differential of F, and then I strip out the differential on F, and I discover that this object is identical to this one. And then I proved this identification. So very, how can I use very concretely this kind of identification? Well, let's try to make things simpler. How can I use this foliation? So let's pick up a basis of my beloved Lie algebra that I want to use, DC. And if I have a basis of this Lie algebra, I can introduce a dual basis as well in the standard way, again with my pairing. So I can introduce the TA star, which is just the dual of the TA by the usual relation. Of course, I have too many A's, probably with a B here. Okay, and now I can play the usual trick and try to identify the differentials of the PAs at a given point, identify them as the elements of the, of G star. And this means if I identify them as elements of G star, this means that when they act on this kind of objects, well, or if you wish, it is natural that here I can have an identification of this type because if I compute this is just delta PA, delta PB. So this is delta BA. But if I do this, this means that I can somehow identify the differentials of the PAs with the TA, essentially because the differentials of the PA belong to G star star, which is the analog of the Lie algebra. So this is a bit fast and sketchy, but I needed it just to say quickly to you that indeed this relation, this definition in a given basis translate into the following. And this is why I needed this argument, because I had to transform, I have to deal with elements that are infinitesimal displacement in the dual Tuvelli algebra, and I need this identification to identify it with the generators of the algebra. And the final result . So what is important is that if I start from a Lie algebra with these structure constants, essentially the Poisson bracket that I defined there translates simply into this Poisson structure PC. And for the moment, this is still a bracket on the wall G, but now on the wall G star, sorry. But now, how can I use this kind of construction in practice? So how can I characterize orbits? And well, the idea is that essentially, let's look back at the example of my beloved example of SO3. In the case of SO3, the orbits were spheres. So this means that essentially they were specified by a given value of a Casimir operator, because the Casimir operator corresponds to a sphere. And this is not a surprise a posteriori, because essentially here you see the same structure as the one of the Lie algebra. And what are the G invariant functions that you can pick up are just the Casimir operators. So this means that one things that we can do to, for instance, classify orbits is just to look at the values of Casimir operators for a generic orbit. I can classify all my G invariant functions, which are in general essentially just the Casimir operator, and I just assign a given value to the Casimir. For each value of the Casimir, I pick up an orbit. In the case of SO3, I just have one Casimir, I fix the value of the Casimir, and I select an orbit. And then what I can do, so these correspond to a classification of my orbits. Then once I identify the orbits there, I can pick up a representative of the orbit, so a point which satisfies this condition, and then act with infinitesimal displacements that were written somewhere on the blackboard, say these ones, and span the whole orbit, and compute what is the induced bracket on the orbit starting from this one. And so that's all. Unfortunately not, because there are kind of exceptional orbits. In which essentially I have either kind of limiting cases of this kind of objects, for instance, when some of the values become zero, or the other thing is that how is it possible that I have other orbits, because this is the full set of invariants of G invariants. The fact is that I can have other G invariants that become G invariants only when I set something to zero. And what does it mean? This means that I can classify ideals in my algebra, and then I can decide to set to zero a given ideal. And this will give me a set of conditions that will play exactly the same role as the conditions that we have here. So it looks something weird, but it's something that we can see in a very simple example, which is Poincaré. Why I'm taking this example, because often people consider these orbits as being very pathological, very difficult to quantize, and so something that we can throw away. Yes, in general, it is the case. But for instance, in the case of Poincaré, these orbits are just massive orbits. And if I want to describe a massless particle, I have to use an exceptional orbit. And so what's the claim is that for a generic orbit, say Poincaré in four dimensions, is specified just by saying that C1, which is equal to PA is equal to m squared, and C2, which is equal to the square of the Pauli-Lubansky operator, is equal to minus m squared s squared. Well, W is just the Pauli-Lubansky operator, which is just 1/2. Well, 1/2 is clearly not important. It's epsilon B C D P B M C D, and P are just the generators of translations, and M are just the generator of rotations. So that is a generic orbit. It's pretty simple. What is the dimension of this orbit? So I have 10 generators in Poincaré. I'm imposing two constraints. The dimension of the orbits is equal to 8. It's even, fine. So it's what we were expecting. But now let's look. But for sure, in this way, I cannot get, where is, here. I cannot get massless particles. But let's see what I can do for massless particles. Well, for massless particle, I may try to say, well, come on, you just take the limit of this guy in which the mass goes to zero. But the problem is that if the mass goes to zero, yes, another important condition is that WA, PA, just by definitions, are equal to zero. So Pauli-Lubansky and momenta are orthogonal. But if I send these two guys to zero, I have two null vectors that are orthogonal, that must be proportional. So this means that the two conditions are not independent anymore. The vanishing of these and the vanishing of these are not independent. I will have only one condition. This doesn't sound right because I need to have an orbit that has a dimension which is even. So what's the way out? Well, the way out is the following. For massless orbits, what I can do is I can impose PA, PA is equal to zero, which, by the way, as I discussed, implies WA, WA equal to zero. So the two conditions are not independent. And the things that I can do is to realize that there is an object, which is the following. Which generates an ideal of my algebra. What does it mean? It means that if I just look at the commutation relations of this object, I get that PA is equal to zero. You just look at the definition, the fact that PA, PA commutes is clear, and the fact that PA with W is zero, it just follows from the definition of PA. I advertise to do the small exercise. And well, that is not a surprising. If you look at the other commutations relation, just must have to tell you that this object just transformed like a Lorentz tensor. Okay. But now, since this object is an ideal, I can set it to zero. And if I set it to zero, its commutation relations are kind of consistent in the sense that I can consistently set it to zero. In the sense, if A, IB is equal to zero, action of translations gives zero again. Action of rotation gives zero again because it is proportional to the ideal itself. And the kind of condition that I've written here, maybe they've written in a way that is a bit less common to be seen, but I just took advantage of the fact that if PA is equal to zero, then omega A is proportional to PA for the reason that I told you, the two null vectors that are orthogonal must be proportional. And what I've done here in picking up a particular ideal has been just to fix the proportionality factor. And fixing the proportionality factor means that I imposed the helicity condition. I fixed the helicity of a particle. So for each value, well, for each discrete value of S, I'm picking up a massless orbit. So that is a nice thing just to say that if I want to classify, another way to classify orbits is just to classify ideals of a given algebra, and then we can impose impose this condition. So that's somehow is just the, eventually just the usual helicity condition written in disguise. Okay. Voilà, so that's what we can. Yes.
I is generating an ideal in the full Poincaré algebra, is that right? Or
yeah, this is an ideal of a Poincaré algebra.
I thought you still have exceptional orbits even like in semi or like in simple cases where there are no ideals. Is that
right? I mean, that's true, but this is, it was just the, this is true. You will see shortly another example of exceptional orbits. So here I presented this one. That's true. Maybe I overstressed. Thank you for the comment. It was just to try to show you an example in which exceptional orbits can make sense.
Okay.
No, but you can obtain them also in different kind of setups. Yes. Well, and thanks for the question, because it also, another characteristics of exceptional orbits is that here I can count the number of conditions. So I have one condition here, and here I have a priori, it seems that I have four of them, but since the two are, since the two vectors are kind of orthogonal, this means that in practice here I have only three independent conditions. So it's 1 - 3 - 4 = 6. So it's just a typical phenomenon is that typically exceptional orbits are the dimension which is smaller with respect to the one of generic ones.
Okay, so those are the standard massless particles, and then
This is just a standard massless particle.
Okay.
Whose coadjoint orbit has this dimension. So this is just an example for fun. So it's just that it's an example in which you can see indeed that you can quantize, of course, this kind of exceptional orbit because it's just a massless particle. It's true that this setup is very different. Thanks for the remark from the one of SO3 because I'm jumping from a semi-simple to a semi-direct product. But this is just. Not to exaggerate with the statements about the fact that these exceptional orbits are wild beasts. There are some examples in which they are kind of pretty useful somehow. But it's true that they are very special in a sense. And I will make some other comments later. And so now rather than entering other questions? Okay, now that was a comment that we discussed over the break. But just very quickly, is that why some orbits, so there are some orbits that we don't know if we can quantize, but there are some orbits that we are pretty sure that we cannot quantize. And the example is again in the case of SO3, where eventually I want to recover the representation of SO3. And the representation of SO3 must be labeled by a continuous parameter, the spin, by a discrete parameter, the spin, not by a continuous one. So what's the problem? So this means that I cannot tune as I wish the radius of the sphere. So how can we understand this? Okay, so one explanations that I found very nice that you can find in the paper by Witten about coadjoint orbits is that essentially the volume of the orbit should correspond roughly to the number of degrees of freedom inside my in my quantization. So this means that this number I cannot change it continuously. So I must have some kind of discrete jumps, and this explains why you may have this kind of discrete jumps. A more precise argument can be found if we look at the techniques of geometric quantization. So in the case of geometric quantization, what it is, this framework is a very well developed and huge framework in which, given a classical phase space, I want to write a Hilbert space of wave function defined on this Hilbert space. I'm not going to enter into the details at all because it is a huge subject and I don't have time, but the things that we have to do roughly is that, given a function on phase space, I want to do two things. And the first thing is that, given a function on phase space, I want to associate it an operator. And this operation is called pre-quantization. And the second step that I have to do is called polarization, because even suppose that I'm able to do this operation, I would associate to any function an operator which still depends on P and Q. But we know that this is not compatible with Heisenberg indetermination principle. So I have to cut by two the number of variables. And choosing a polarization tells you how you select a true wave function. So for instance, one example of polarization is that you say that all your wave functions are such that they actually depend on your coordinates and not on momenta. Okay, so that is extremely sketchy, but what interests me is that there is kind of standard way of getting, of performing at least the step of pre-quantization, and it is to associate to any function an operator which is just associated to the Hamiltonian vector field associated to the function. Why? Because roughly we have seen that vector fields satisfy through the Lie bracket the algebra that I want to impose. So, and this is just the commutator, the Lie commutator. So we can try to promote the Lie commutator to become the commutator of my quantum theory. Again, so let me stress again that it's extremely sketchy what I'm going to tell you. So the only thing why I'm entering into these details is that one way to perform a map that preserve the commutators is via the following things. And somehow we can try to understand why we have to do this. And the reason why I start to put this this term is that, as I advertise, this is due to the fact that these objects satisfy the right algebra. So this means that these objects as commutator, well, if I would have put only this guy here, they would have satisfied precisely, I would have found a way to promote the Poisson bracket of function to be a truly Lie bracket of operators. Unfortunately, that cannot be the end of the story, because if I only do this, I have a problem, and the problem is that the operator which is associated to one will be, in this particular case, to the identity, would be just zero, while somehow I would like to have it to be the identity, not zero, essentially. So, well, let me see. And this is not good. But I can correct this problem just by putting the function f there. So that is solving all my problem. But if I do this, then I spoil the Lie bracket. And then I'm forced to add this object here. And there I have to explain you what is this object. So this is just my pairing. So if you wish, it's a pairing with the Hamiltonian flow, Hamiltonian vector. And this object is just a one form such that my omega is equal to differential of this one form. Okay, so, well, I just ask you to kindly trust me that if you do this operation, then you obtain operators that satisfy precisely the, if I compute the bracket of these two operators, I reproduce the Poisson brackets. And, well, again, example. And everything that I said may look complicated, but if I go in Darboux coordinates, so locally, what does it mean, this? That's locally, I can always rewrite my symplectic form this way. And then there is easily, I can easily find a theta, which is just the following. And then if I implement all the story that I told you, what I discover is that the operator which is associated to the QJ is just I H bar the PJ plus QJ, and the operator which is associated to the PJ is equal to minus H bar the QJ. So this is not very surprising if you remember your quantum mechanics classes, and this is just unfortunately an example. What's the problem in trying to promote this story in the general case. So if I'm in quantum mechanics, it's fine, because what I've done here, or if you wish, my symplectic manifold is a cotangent bundle, there are no problems. So what is true locally is true also globally, but this is not true in general. And in general, I have a problem. And the problem is that it's unclear if I can found this form theta. And the reason is the following, is that locally, thanks to the Poincaré lemma on a given, in a given chart, I can clearly solve it. I can always find a theta I that, so since this form is closed, locally it is also exact. So this is just Poincaré lemma. But unfortunately, I have to glue the patches. And I can glue patches if and only if the integral of any given closed surface of these objects is an integer. And this implies, in the case of SO3, that the only somehow coadjoint orbits on which, if I do an integral on these coadjoint orbits, I obtain an integer, are the sphere with a quantized radius. So you see, first mechanism, and this clear, in this case, is really crystal shortcut result. The other sphere, I cannot quantize them, and it makes sense, because I just have to recover the representations of SO3. Unfortunately, more complicated cases, this could be more complicated. We may have stuff that satisfy this condition, so that a priori we know how to quantize, but that, that a priori can be quantizable, but unfortunately we don't know how to quantize, because essentially what is true locally here is not true globally, essentially. Yes?
Sorry, I just wanted to clarify that your formula for f hat, are the two corrections to the vector fields just multiplication by a scalar function? Those are both scalar functions. Is that how to interpret those two terms?
Yes. So in the sense, yes. So you can see it here, essentially.
Okay.
So it's just a kind of abstract rewriting of this stuff here.
Uh-huh.
And... yeah, you say, so this means with the bracket that you compute here, I mean, these objects simply, you can interpret it as being proportional to the identity. That is maybe more correct. Yeah, so they do not contribute to the bracket, in a sense, at least this one, but they help you to restore other properties that are around.
Okay, and then the quantization condition, you said this is an obstruction to the pre-quantization step, is that
exactly right? It's an obstruction to perform the pre-quantization, exactly. Okay. Because it's an obstruction to find a theta which is globally well-defined. I mean, I'm not at all an expert of this story, so I just try to get a catch from where they are coming from, but let's say, so I think that the important message to grab is that there is a quantization condition, and just passed through this formula in order, it seems to me, that the most easiest way to say why there is a quantization condition is to pass through the non-global well-definedness of this object there. And of course, I haven't explained how you move from where to there, but that's, it was just to have an idea of a framework somehow.
Andrea, there is a question in the chat for you. I'm here. Hi. Does S2 becomes pre-quantizable if one identifies the antipodal points, that is, if one considers the real projected 3 space?
What does it mean, pre-quantizable all orbits?
Yes.
I mean, I have no idea, so I never thought about it. Yeah, I don't know. I have to think about it. So maybe, well, if someone in the audience has a clear answer, but I don't know. To be honest, I suspect not, but I don't know. Okay, so, well, now, so that is kind of so we discovered that not all orbits can be pre-quantized and then quantized. So are there some classes of orbits okay that can be quantized? Well, yes, in the sense that for sure these orbits can be quantized. So if my orbit by chance is a cotangent bundle, I can quantize it. And another class of orbits that I can quantize are Keller manifolds, because if my orbit is a Keller manifold, then there is all a kind of procedure, because I have a way to essentially the curvature of the Keller form will give me my symplectic form. So my time is over. So I promised to arrive up to Virasoro, but I didn't manage to do. Maybe let me just conclude with a kind of quick overview of an example that is a bit more complicated with respect to my SO3 example. And it is kind of a prototype of Virasoro, and it is the orbits of SL2R. So in this case of SL2R, what do we have? So we said that orbits can be classified by Casimir. So this means that in this case, I have an algebra, which is just the algebra of SL2R. And orbits are just identified by selecting this kind of, by imposing this kind of relation. With R squared that belongs to R. But now you see that the structure of the orbits, even if the setup looks similar, it's very much different. And so what type of orbits do I have? I have these orbits. They correspond to R squared, which is positive, and clearly the corresponding counterpart there. And I have these orbits here, which correspond to R squared negative. I have the cone, which corresponds to R squared is equal to zero, and I have the origin, in which all the pi are equal to zero. So now I can ask myself, what are the representations corresponding to these orbits? So this one is easy. So the origin is just a trivial representation. You can always have a trivial orbit and the corresponding trivial representation. This object here and this object here are both generic orbits, but this is it gives rise to the discrete series. While the other one, yeah, here is is the continuous principal series. And the cone, we don't know, even in such a simple case. And the other thing that you can see is that the complementary series is missing. So here you see a kind of nice example. This one I can easily quantize because this orbit is the Keller manifold. So done. This orbit I can quantize because it is a cotangent bundle. Essentially, it's a tangent, a line bundle over the circle here. Well, these orbits I know how to do. This exceptional orbit I don't know how to quantize. So there is an orbit that I don't know what it is. And I have a representation with a series of representation which is missing, a continuous series of representation that is missing. And just a last comment, and then I stop. And for the Virasoro, well, if you wish, we can discuss later. The last comment is that here there is a free parameter, which is the radius. And here there is a free parameter as well. So in this idea that somehow this parameter gives me kind of the volume of a phase space, I can look at large values of these parameters and hope to have a semi-classical approximation to the quantization of this orbit. So you see why, in some sense, these two orbits are kind of good. And in general, the generic one are good because I can imagine to do a sort of semi-classical approximation, which means in general that I just pick up a representative, I do an expansion around it, and I try to do a semi-classical quantization. But this one doesn't have any free parameter, so there is no h-bar. So this means that the cone is an orbit in which I cannot even imagine to do a sort of semi-classical approximation to the quantization. This is why exceptional orbits are harder. Although in this particular case, we see another example of exceptional orbits in the sense that this exceptional orbit here is obtained as a limit of standard ones. So in particular, I don't have this phenomenon of having a different dimension. So somehow there is a huge zoology of in coadjuvant orbits, but yeah, unfortunately, I didn't have time to arrive there. They are very useful in cases in which we don't know what to do. So here we know the representation is just a matter of matching, but for infinite dimensional groups, we have no idea in many cases. And so these methods is sufficiently streamlined to try to attack it and obtain at least some of the representation, maybe not all of them, but some of them can be obtained with these techniques. So thank you for your attention and sorry for the delay.
Thank you very much, Andrea. Yes.
Is it obvious or an accident that all the representations of SL2R are unitary?
Well, good point. That goes back to the previous question. So, well, it could be that there is a result in which they must be all unitary for the case of this kind of finite dimensional groups, but it's a bit unclear to me because here I just swapped under the carpet also another thing that I have to being able to define an Hermitian product here to decide if they are unitary or not. And even, say, in this case here, it's not something which is completely obvious, no, because I can just say that this is a Kähler manifold. I just take holomorphic functions on the orbit, but that are transformed under the action of a conformal group. But if I just take this, the scalar product, which is just the integral of f with g, I have no square integrable function. So then, in this case, I know how to define it. So I just put a weight, another function, and so on and so forth. So I arrive to define the Hermitian product. To be honest, it's a bit unclear to me. I must have to admit also that I used some sort of classical references to deal into. So it could be that some mathematicians have more modern, but it's a bit unclear to me. And in the case of Virasoro, for instance, I was mentioning this kind of non-unitary representations that are unbounded from below. And that is a work for Joris Raymakers. He's studying this kind of orbits for motivations that are related to ADS3 gravit. And to be honest, I think that he's trying to do a semi-classical quantization of these orbits, and that must be non-unitary orbits. So they correspond to points into the of the central charge, which is clear that the representation is non-unitary. So for finite dimensional groups, I don't know. For infinite dimensional ones, I would say that there are some examples in which, well, maybe where the quantization is not worked out in full detail, but they point toward the direction that you may also have something non-unitary. But that's, it may be that it's just my ignorance that I don't know, unfortunately.
Thank you very much. I will cut it there because we are already running late. And let's thanks, Andrea, again for his like Ruby joke.